Thanks so much for joining us. We're on a great weather run. Happy 4th of July weekend. What a beautiful 4th it was, and it looks like another great day today. And Tom Schroer joining us in studio on this holiday weekend. Tom, always great to see you.
Steve, it's so fun to be here again, and you're right, it is just a terrific holiday here. Of course, we celebrate the birth of our nation, and we have a special program around that today. And we just also wanted to reach out and say hello and express our best wishes to our friend and partner at the law firm, Art Dickinson, as he recovers at Abbott Northwestern here this weekend. And also to mention that we are, again, excited to be here to be able to share with the listening audience information that we hope is helpful and pertinent to them as they move through their busy lives and with businesses. And Moss and Barnett does focus on business, of course, and the rights and legal obligations of individuals. But we also wanted to talk today about something perhaps more fundamental, well, obviously more fundamental, and that is the Bill of Rights. As we know, on the 4th, we do focus heavily on the Declaration of Independence, which was what birthed our nation back on July 4, 1776. But really, it was the Bill of Rights that provides the superstructure or framework for our individual liberties, which, of course, were deemed so important at the time when we did break away from Great Britain. And so for that purpose and to assist in our dissection of some current cases, we have we're deeply honored to have, I might add, our senior partner, Tom Keller, with us today. Tom Keller was raised in Lake Elmo and graduated from Stillwater High School, Steve, where after graduating college, he and law school, he became one of the early founding partners of the O'Connor and Hannon Law Firm. And Patrick O'Connor and Joel Walters were already at that firm and active, working with Senator Hubert Humphrey as his chief fundraisers and lawyers. And that really is where Tom began his career, which has included not only serving as Senator Humphrey's lawyer for many, many years and active in his campaigns, but also Tom has been active in the life of our community here, Steve, including extensive involvement at the University of Minnesota, supporting it in fundraising, serving as its legal counsel for a number of years, and other aspects of the development of the U, but also working for legal services for the poor, supporting heart research and the arts. And I know Tom, being here in the studio here, must really bring back some nostalgia because, as we know, Senator Humphrey was very, very connected here with WCCO AM radio in his career.
Yes, he was, Tom. And Hubert Humphrey was a great hero of mine when I was in undergraduate and in law school. And so it was a great piece of luck on my part to be hired by Pat O'Connor and Joe Walters, the law partners who were his chief fundraisers and lawyers.
And what an energetic man he was. I can remember, I was still young when Hubert Humphrey passed away, and I remember very vividly his funeral and how many people attended his funeral, and what a momentous day that was when Hubert Humphrey passed away. He had a tremendous influence, not only here in the state, but a tremendous influence on our country.
He did, Steve, and I would like to just take a minute to tell you why Hubert Humphrey originally became a great hero of mine. He remains one of my heroes. It was because of a very courageous speech he gave at the 1948 Democratic National Convention. He led the Minnesota delegation there, and at that time, he was this 37-year-old mayor of Minneapolis, which, according to the powers that be, did not qualify him for a high status in political circles. At that time, then Mayor Humphrey was preparing to run for the U.S. Senate for the first time against an incumbent. He was also on fire about civil rights. At that convention, they were going to nominate President Truman to run for the first time for the presidency. He had become president when FDR died. They were very nervous at that time because Truman was going to face Tom Dewey. There was a third party had been formed by a fellow named Wallace that was going to siphon votes away from the Democrats. They didn't want anyone rocking the boat. Humphrey was determined at that convention to get into the Democratic national platform a strong civil rights plank. He was opposed by the party powers. They were afraid of losing the South. Nonetheless, he got time on the floor. He put his plank out there, and in an historic, courageous speech, he put the plank out there and said in ending, "The time has come for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadow of states' rights and walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of civil rights." The plank was adopted just barely, and Truman and his people were furious. They had warned him if he did that, his political career would be over. That's what he risked. Of course, Truman was elected, Hubert Humphrey was elected, and going forward to the funeral you just mentioned, Steve, and of course I was at that funeral, one of his colleagues, for that reason, called him the orator of the dawn. And bear in mind, when he had that speech, made that speech, it was 6 years before Brown versus Board of Education, the U.S. Supreme Court's outlawing of segregation in the schools.
Wow. Tom, that really points out why the Bill of Rights are so important. And, of course, we know that individuals in our community continue to be challenged in understanding what the Bill of Rights are all about, and they really are about the rights that we have as individuals for freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of association, the freedom to be not unreasonably detained by the government, etc. And Tom, I wonder if you could just share with us briefly why you believe the Bill of Rights matter to people and why they matter to you.
Well, they matter to me a great deal, and they matter to all Americans. One aspect of our Constitution, which includes the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, is that these rights are not automatically enforced. And as a matter of fact, for the first 120 or 30 years of their existence, no one took steps to enforce them. For instance, at the dawn of the 20th century, segregation was rampant everywhere in the United States, with all of its depredations visited on African Americans and other minorities. It was illegal to organize labor unions. Women did not have the rights to vote. Legal immigrants were deported for their political views. It was not until 1925 that the Supreme Court ruled that the courts could enforce the provisions of the Bill of Rights protecting speech, the right to assemble, the Fifth Amendment rights, and so on and so forth. And right down to the present time, the Supreme Court recently ruled on gun control, Second Amendment issues, and on habeas corpus issues.
We have a break coming up. We have much more with Tom Keller, our host, of course, Tom Schroyer from Moss and Barnett. By the way, they have a wonderful website, moss-barnett.com. We invite you to visit that website at your earliest convenience. We have much more coming up. It is Minnesota Law on this holiday weekend. Happy 4th of July to you and yours. It is 12:18 on a great day. Welcome back. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. We're here each and every Saturday at noon. And today in the spotlight, the Bill of Rights. And if you have a question about the Bill of Rights and how it impacts you and how it impacts all of us as Americans, the phone lines are always open on the program at 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. Tom Schroyer is our host, our special guest, Tom Keller.
Steve, we do very much welcome calls, especially today, as always. And talking again about the Bill of Rights, which, you know, in some measure are words on a piece of paper. And, Tom, there are a surprising number of countries in the world that have almost verbatim adopted our Bill of Rights, yet are ruled by dictators or are otherwise lacking in democratic freedoms. And so that raises the importance of, you know, why is it, or the question of why is it that in America we have such an actively vital Bill of Rights?
That's right, Tom. And the key to enforcement of rights that are set down on paper in a constitution are an independent court system, independent of the government, the central government, and a vigorous independent bar where lawyers are available to people to enforce those rights. The Declaration of Independence, which is a great indictment of tyranny, lists the abuses of King George III toward the colonies. One of them that's called out is that King George appointed judges, and they served at his pleasure, and he set their salaries, and he could cut off their salaries. He could fire them at his pleasure. It's one of the markers of tyranny, and consequently, in countries that have adopted something that looks like our Constitution, can turn into dictatorships if the central government has that power.
And Tom, that very debate arose at the Constitutional Convention when the Constitution was adopted, and in the years following when it was passed by the states and enacted, around the issue of whether or not the central government had been given too much power, and if in turn the individual rights that we now call the Bill of Rights shouldn't be enshrined in what we now know as the Bill of Rights.
That's right. The original impetus to the Constitutional Convention was that there were disturbing signs of chaos in the colonies, and it was thought a strong central government was needed. But some of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention refused to attend. Because, and Patrick Henry was one of them, he said, "I smell a rat," meaning that it looked to him like a tyrannical, potentially tyrannical, central government was going to be established. And in the end, a Bill of Rights was not adopted, but the price of getting the Constitution ratified was assurances to people like Patrick Henry one would be. And it was adopted 2 years later.
And the Bill of Rights continue to be important in our country, in our society. They affect rights of people today, and the Supreme Court continues to make decisions which people find to be both maddening or infuriating and just plain wrong, or the most perfect words of wisdom ever. And so it's really something that is, again, very, very central to our form of government. And one of the recent decisions that I know we wanted to talk to involved the detainees at Guantanamo Bay, the case of Boumediene versus Bush, decided just a few weeks ago on June 12, which involved the right under the writ of habeas corpus, which is not in the Bill of Rights.
That's right. Habeas corpus was one individual right that every one of the original framers of the Constitution agreed ought to be enshrined. And so that was put in the original Constitution. And by the way, the Guantanamo case, which has focused some criticism on President Bush, is not unusual in our history. And people are fond of labeling their political enemies as destroyers of the Constitution and so on. But no particular political party has a monopoly on that.
We are going to take a break. We have the news and weather coming up. We have more on the Bill of Rights. Tom Keller, our guest today. Tom Schroyer, the host on the program, and that program is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Available online, we invite you to go to the website moss-barnett.com. This is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Happy 4th of July holiday weekend. Tom Schroyer is our host, our special guest in studio, Tom Keller. The Bill of Rights in the spotlight today, and this is a very important topic and a complex topic.
It is, Steve, and we were just getting around to talking about the recent case involving the Guantanamo Bay detainees and how much controversy and interest that case has stirred. And even though that doesn't involve a part of the Bill of Rights because it was included in the Constitution, Tom, in a way that underscores why it came to pass that we have a Bill of Rights, as you were saying, because those who thought the central government was rendered too powerful by the Constitution wanted to have protections for individual liberties, and that's represented in the Guantanamo Bay case in the sense that the judiciary, here the Supreme Court, overruled an act of Congress that authorized the detention relatively indefinitely of the captives from the Mideast war on terror.
That's true, Tom. And the founders of our country, particularly some of the drafters of the Constitution, such as Jefferson, said eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. And what they were talking about is eternal suspicion of the central government encroaching on liberties. And in the case of habeas, the Supreme Court, in making its ruling, said that Congress cannot alter that which is in the Constitution. The right of habeas corpus, the right of somebody who is detained by the government to quickly have a day in court to call the government to account. Why am I here? And, of course, to have witnesses and evidence in their favor. And on that point, Madison, one of the founders, said, the central government cannot switch on and off provisions of the Constitution to suit its purposes.
Tom, one of the things that we wanted to talk about was the role played by some famous Minnesota lawsuits in the development of the Bill of Rights, specifically in the area of free speech. And perhaps the leading case on its point, and one of the earliest on the free speech doctrine, is the case of Neer versus Minnesota.
That's right. That case arose in the late 20s, and the case was decided in 1930. Neer was the publisher of what by any measure was a yellow journal newspaper. It was scurrilous, it was bigoted, it was anti-Semitic, but it was particularly annoying to politicians who the paper would regularly call out for corruption. And there was a lot of it going on in Minneapolis and St. Paul at that time. The Hennepin County attorney, acting under an ordinance probably adopted to get rid of this publication, got an injunction against its publication, put it out of business. The U.S. Supreme Court said, you can't do that. It's called prior restraint. What you can do is sue the publisher and writers for libel, for defamation, and so forth, but no prior restraint. And that became the law of the land to this day.
And so that case, Neer versus Minnesota, is really one of the leading cases under the Bill of Rights for the protection of free speech.
It is.
And then we more recently had another case on the other side of the coin, in a manner of speaking, and that involved a hate crime ordinance at the city of St. Paul called RAV versus the city of St. Paul, in which the Supreme Court dealt with an effort by St. Paul to prohibit the burning of crosses.
That's right. And the U.S. Supreme Court in that case threw out the hate crimes ordinance on the basis that what they were, what it was designed to punish was a thought, a message, a hateful one to be sure. But the U.S. Supreme Court said you can prosecute somebody who burns a cross on your lawn for trespass or for violating a fire ordinance, but you cannot punish them for expressing a thought.
And it goes to show that the Bill of Rights, while it lays out a lot of things, these are constantly being challenged. None of these rights are absolute. You just can't say what you feel and say, well, that's freedom of speech. I think the best example I've heard that helps explain it is you can't go into a crowded theater and yell fire because you feel like it, to see what will happen, that there are consequences and there are limits to all of this.
You're absolutely right, Steve. And the Supreme Court has ruled time and again that none of the rights in the Bill of Rights is absolute. And even in the recent Second Amendment case, where the Supreme Court affirmed the right of individuals to bear arms in their homes, Justice Scalia wrote for the majority that this does not mean that the right to bear arms cannot be regulated in the interests of public safety.
But times change, and at certain points in our history, people have argued that these rights ought to be taken absolutely. For example, Justice Hugo Black was a strong proponent of that notion, Tom.
Yes, he was, and he's an example of a justice who came on the court over a firestorm of protest from liberals because he was a Southerner who had belonged at one time to the Ku Klux Klan. Everyone thought this man would be a disaster for civil liberties. By the time he left the court, he was the darling of civil libertarians because, as you said, Tom, Justice Black said time and again, listen, the Bill of Rights is there for all to see. It means what it says, and let's not mess with it.
We'll get a chance to see this in action this summer when the Republican National Convention is held in town, and we know already that there is going to be a fair amount of controversy involving when and where and under what circumstances protesters can address their thoughts toward the Republican Convention.
That's absolutely right, and there is currently litigation in Ramsey County by organizations who want parade permits and assembly permits to protest. And they are asserting First Amendment rights to petition, to assemble, the free speech rights protected by the First Amendment. And some of the officials in the city of St. Paul are saying, hold on just a minute. We have public safety concerns, which are legitimate, of course, to argue. It'll be interesting to see how that one sorts out.
Is that a topic, as attorneys, you see, that one has the potential to go all the way to the Supreme Court? Do you see cases in your experience where it has the earmarks of something that may make it all the way to the Supreme Court? Because it gets right down to freedom of assembly. These people have the right to assembly. And at what point in time does someone in power or the government or the police say, you know what, we're tired of these people, and under the guise of public safety, we're not going to allow these people to assemble? In your experience, is there something that stands out as that could make it all the way?
You're absolutely right, Steve. And it could, depending on where St. Paul city officials draw that line. What comes to mind in my recent history, not yours, young man, is the Chicago Democratic Convention of 68,
sure,
where there were terrible abuses, and protesters were beat up, and we all know what happened.
Awful.
That was a terrible infringement of their constitutional rights. In New York, in the Republican National Convention that was held there, that was a disaster. The police were not sufficiently instructed restrained from making mass arrests that were inappropriate. And I've noticed in news reports that the city of St. Paul has been consulting with New York officials, so St. Paul doesn't make the same mistakes.
Thomas, we will watch for those developments very actively. It'll be hard for those kinds of issues to be presented directly to the Supreme Court in time for it to make a difference this summer. It is possible, of course, that something will happen that will lead to ensuing long-term litigation that might get there, but that's not the likeliest scenario.
We're going to take a break. It is Minnesota Law, presented by Moss and Barnett. Tom Schroyer is our host. We're here each and every Saturday. Tom Keller joining us in studio. We're talking about the Bill of Rights. And if you have a question about the Bill of Rights, 651-989-9226 or 1-866-989-9226. By the way, moss-barnett.com is a website. It is Minnesota Law. Our hour goes so quickly. Tom Schroyer, our host each and every week at noon. Tom Keller joining us in studio. The Bill of Rights in the spotlight.
One of the things- things we've been talking about here today is the importance and relevance of the Bill of Rights, but also, Tom, you mentioned a theme, which is that there's been surprisingly little litigation in some measure about some of the Bill of Rights protections for hundreds, literally, of years. And we had an example of that just last week when the Supreme Court finally, for the first time, decided in the gun control case involving the District of Columbia that the right to bear arms is an individual, not a collective right.
That's right. And it was a very exhaustive, well-reasoned opinion. Whether you agree with the outcome of the case or not, technically, it was very well written. One interesting thing, as I mentioned briefly a moment ago, is that it does not lay to rest a host of issues as to how far the government can go in regulating the right to own guns. That is yet to be decided.
All right, we go to Ed in Orono. Ed, happy 4th of July weekend. Hello.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm enjoying Mr. Keller. He's got great insight. Mr. Keller, I wanted to ask you about the right to bear arms. Do you think that rationale in that decision is accurate? I have two questions. In terms of, obviously, it talks about a well-regulated militia, and they've carried it over to every citizen. And then the second issue is, and I think it ties into what you just said, and that is the regulation by the government. I mean, is there a difference between hunting weapons, which, of course, are very important to people in our state, and also military assault weapons? Can we regulate those under this decision?
Those are great, very insightful questions, I must say. The short answer is we don't know what the Supreme Court might say about assault weapon bans. That was not addressed directly in the Heller case. That's the District of Columbia case. There is a statement in the decision that you can have a long gun, like a hunting gun, in your home. You can have a handgun in your home. They put it on the basis of protecting the home. But what was not addressed is the whole smorgasbord, if you will, of possible gun regulations. As we speak, Ed, the District of Columbia government is redrafting their ordinance not to ban handguns entirely. That was thrown out, but to regulate them in some fashion. I will quickly throw in a technical point, but an important one. Remember that the District of Columbia is governed by the federal government. We still do not have a case involving regulation by a city or a state. And both Chicago and San Francisco have similar bans to the one thrown out in the District of Columbia, and suits have already been filed to test those ordinances.
Thomas, one of the points that we wanted to draw here today is that, of course, there's something for everybody when the Supreme Court starts issuing opinions. People are upset and even infuriated on both sides of the political spectrum here, and I think that's represented this past June by the Guantanamo Bay case and the handgun case. And, of course, the swing vote in those cases was Justice Kennedy. And doesn't that show that the judges have too much power, and that here in this situation, in fact, this past month, that a fair amount of power is reposed in one single individual who changes which side he votes on from case to case?
There can be that perception, Tom, but I don't believe it's accurate. In 5-4 decisions, we see that operating. And by the way, going back to our earlier discussion of Neer against Minnesota, the Freedom of Press case, that was a 5-4 decision. We've seen a lot of 5-4 decisions in recent Supreme Court sessions. But the genius of our form of government, if you will, is that we do repose ultimate power in the Supreme Court to decide issues of constitutionality. It is the institution and not individuals that have that power. And it's remarkable that after more than 200 years, we still respect that power. Nobody challenges it. Unlike, for instance, recently in Pakistan, where the president of Pakistan found a Supreme Court ruling uncomfortable for him, so he fired the Supreme Court. That's not happening here.
Well, the show has gone very quickly. Tom, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Really an honor. Thanks so much for coming in.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be with you, Steve. Thanks for the opportunity.
And Tom, an hour's gone very quickly. A fascinating topic, the Bill of Rights, on this 4th of July weekend. We'll be back next Saturday at noon. Next Saturday, an important show as well.
It really is, Steve. We're going to be talking about elder care and all of the issues that can arise when folks get along the age continuum and what we can do legally to plan for that and help with that.
A very important topic coming up on the show. As always, it is Minnesota Law presented by Moss and Barnett. Online at moss-barnett.com. Thanks to our studio coordinator, Dennis Matuszak. I'm Steve Thompson. Enjoy your Saturday. Enjoy your holiday weekend.